War and Democracy, next on Soundings. This is Wine Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with historian Mark Mazower of the University of Sussex. He's here now to talk about war and democracy in 20th century Europe.
The First World War, of course, is crucial because you have two political forces emerging out of the fighting, rivals, both of whom claim that they have the key to the end of history. The first of these being Lenin and the Bolsheviks in Russia, and the second being Woodrow Wilson. So to understand European history in the 20th century, which is what interests me, but also international history more generally, one has to realize the fundamental importance of this starting point.
Historian Mark Mazower, he'll be back in just a moment to discuss war and democracy in 20th century Europe. Funding for this program comes from the Annenberg Foundation, with additional support from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The summer of 1994 brings us several important anniversaries in 20th century European history. Last month, we saw the 50th anniversary of D-Day. This month marks the Allied liberation of Paris. But according to one scholar who recently worked at the National Humanities Center, too often we think of those events as isolated moments, unrelated to a larger picture of 20th century European politics and culture. Mark Mazower is a lecturer in history at the University of Sussex. His book about the Nazi occupation of Greece was published last year, and he's now expanding that study to explore the experience of Nazi occupation elsewhere in Europe. Over the next 30 minutes, Mark Mazower will reflect on what he calls the sweep of history in 20th century Europe. He says that one convenient starting point for such a discussion is the end of World War I, when Europe found itself facing two dominant political ideologies. On the one hand, there was liberal democracy, as embodied by President Woodrow Wilson. In contrast to that, there was Lenin's Soviet communism. With that as a backdrop, I asked Mark Mazower to discuss the fortunes of democracy in 20th century Europe. He begins by commenting on military history and its place in the context of European culture over the last 80 years.
A lot of my work has involved trying to find alternative ways of writing about war, in particular about the Second World War. In Europe, the bulk of the casualties in the Second World War were civilian, not battlefield casualties, unlike the First World War. So one has to find a way of describing the experience of war which conveys what it meant to civilians. It was, if you like, more a civilian experience than it was a military experience. It was, in fact, a number of wars rolled into one, of which the war on the battlefields and at sea was only part. And in particular, if one wants to appreciate the historical significance of a war like the Second World War, one has to see it in a broader context, not just as a series of military engagements, because, of course, those come to an end in 1945, but the longer-term psychological, social, economic consequences roll on. To understand those, you have to understand their origins in the war itself.
Do I take this to mean, Mark Mazower, that you are going to abandon what might be referred to as diplomatic history, the history of great men in particular, and maybe some men who are not so great, to look at history from the bottom up?
I'm going to try to mesh the two. I don't think anybody believes any longer that history is made solely by great men. There was quite a widespread movement amongst historians a generation or so back who argued that it wasn't made by great men at all. I don't think that many people would believe that today. You only need to look in the newspapers and read about what's happening in South Africa or what was happening in the Soviet Union a few years ago to appreciate the importance of political leadership. On the other hand, political leadership takes place in a social context. Mm-hmm. So one has to find a way of writing history that allows one to do justice to both sides of the equation.
Mark Mazower, you have written that when we look back to the history of World War I and then the generations that succeeded it, what we're looking at is an attempt to figure out how democracy works. One democracy, you say, succumbing to dictatorship after another. You also write that Hitler, this struck me as very unusual, that Hitler wasted an opportunity to create a unified Europe. And is democracy the proper word to use here?
I think that when we've looked back at the interwar period, we've tended to look back from our own post-war complacency. We've assumed that democracy was the natural condition of Europe, and that therefore what we have to explain is its breakdown and the rise of fascist regimes. If one looks at what Europeans were actually writing in the late 1920s and the early 1930s, one sees that what they were writing about was what they called the crisis of democracy. In other words, there was an increasing feeling that democracy in Europe had failed.
They were losing faith in it.
They were losing faith in it for a whole variety of reasons, some of them very good, to do with the Great Depression and so forth, and they were prepared to try a variety of alternative paths. And this means that when the Second World War broke out in 1939, it is not the case the large number of Europeans were innately predisposed against any kind of authoritarian solution. On the contrary, we find in the initial reception of the Germans some looking forward to a new authoritarian, more disciplined, more orderly world in Europe. Then, of course, they realize what it is going to be like under the Nazis, and that is not what they bargained for at all.
How this is like asking you, Mark Mazar, how the Roman Empire fell apart, but how do you account for Hitler's dissolution, his political or military dissolution? Was it his own inherent weaknesses, or was it the fact that he met a stronger opponent?
Well, of course, it was both. That is to say that ultimately he suffers a military defeat. However, part of my argument in talking about a wasted opportunity and talking about a Europe that is ready for a new authoritarian regime is to point out that had his political philosophy been slightly different, it's not at all clear that he could have been dislodged from Europe. The problem was that most Europeans were looking forward to some kind of authoritarian leadership. What they were not looking forward to was domination by Germany, by a regime inspired by a racialist philosophy that subordinated most of them to a horrible life. That was where Hitler wasted his opportunity.
Mark Mazar, how does all of this bear on what we might term the relationship between the state and the individual, that is to say the social contract that existed in Europe as a continent over the course of 20th century politics?
Well, I think the war and Hitler's rise and fall had an enormous impact upon this. There was a sea change in ideas about human rights, for example. The idea that the individual has some sort of inalienable rights against the state is one of the rallying points for the opposition to Hitler, and becomes therefore one of the trump cards of the Allies in the war against Hitler, leads to the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights and so on. So that in the sphere of rights and law, there is a complete revolution, and if you like, a resuscitation of the idea of human rights and human dignity. What is also interesting, of course, is that in the sphere of economics, this does not happen. And in fact, what the war does is to consolidate the position of those who argue that the war has shown that Hitler and the Germans and the authoritarians must not be allowed to have all the good ideas themselves. In other words, that there was a core
right
that was appealing. And that core was the state's intervention in the economy, its repudiation of laissez-faire, bringing people into work, building motorways if necessary. All this must be taken on board in the post-war world if the new democracies are to survive.
This goes to the old cliche about Mussolini making the trains run on time. That is to say, placing the individual into some sort of a social context where there is, what, an assurance, a comfort that things are going to run as somebody up the line is planning them. Is that right?
Well, it's interesting to note that the phrase welfare state is coined in 1940. By the Archbishop of Canterbury, who says that we must show that we are fighting against a warfare state for a welfare state.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the fight against Hitler forces the Western powers to define some kind of social guarantees for their populations. After all, these are the people they are calling on to fight against Hitler, and most of these people do not really care very much about Poland. But they do care a great deal about banishing the unemployment of the 1930s, getting a better education for their children, and these then are the fruits of the victory against Hitler.
You are describing, after a fashion, some of the avenues that we take when we try to understand the phenomenon of nationalism. That is to say, how is it that a people would surrender its collective will to a dictator, to somebody who is going to show them exactly, you know, lead them Lord knows where? That's what happened to the Germans, isn't it?
Yes, that is what happened to the Germans, and I suppose there are two aspects to that. One is that Hitler appeared to offer them a way out of slump and depression, and another is that he appeared to offer them a way out of the humiliations that they felt the Versailles Treaty after the First World War had exposed them to. That is probably more important as an element of Hitler's appeal to the nationalists. On the other hand, his appeal to many other sections of the population was based, as I've said, on the fact that he was repudiating the ideas about the free market, which many of the previous governments had been wedded to, and indeed which the British and to a lesser extent the French were still wedded to right through the 1930s.
Well, as we look, Mark Mazower, to the post-World War II period of European history, what is it that brought back to life the claims of liberal democracy? If Hitler had succeeded to the degree that he did, what is it that happened to this concept of liberal democracy to bring it back to the political fore?
I think there are two things. The first is the horror of living under Hitler's occupation discredited ideas of authoritarianism and made people appreciate the value of political liberty and political freedoms. And the second is that the form of democracy that they enjoyed after the war was profoundly changed as a result of the war itself. In other words, it was rather less a liberal democracy in the sense of being a democracy with a minimum state intervention, and much more a form of social democracy or welfare state democracy in which the state played a much more important role guaranteeing the security of its citizens. And that was a far more attractive instrument for obtaining allegiance of large numbers of people than the old laissez-faire state had been. And of course, the third thing that one should mention in Europe after the war is the economic miracle that from perhaps 1948, 49 until the mid-1960s, perhaps even 1970, you see economic growth rates of unprecedented height. This is a period with no parallel in history. It is not surprising that the political forms that were dominant during that period should have attracted the support of large numbers of people.
Mark Mazower, let's shift gears for a moment and open something of a parenthesis. Talk to me for a few minutes about this book that you have written about the Nazi occupation of Greece, where we'll continue our discussion about what you call the sweep of European history. But for now, I want to spend a few minutes on Inside Hitler's Greece, the experience of what happened to the Greek people. You begin by discussing Kurt Waldheim. How about this? How does he enter the picture?
Well, the book began with some work that I did for a TV production. A few years ago, at the time when everybody was fascinated by what Kurt Waldheim had done in the Balkans, he'd actually spent 18 months in Greece, and I spent some time in Greece trying to find out precisely what he'd done.
He was a Nazi officer, is this right?
He was an officer, he was an Austrian, he was an officer in the Wehrmacht, in the German army. He had been invalided out from the Eastern Front. He'd spent some time in what is now Bosnia. And then he'd come to Salonika in northern Greece in the summer of 1943, which coincidentally was just the time at which Salonika's entire Jewish population was being deported. And at that time, there was a great deal of speculation that Waldheim may have been involved, since he was a staff officer and an intelligence officer, in the deportation of Salonika's Jewish population to Auschwitz. I became interested in him, therefore, and started to work my way through the microfilms of the German army records, which are actually commercially available. And I came to the conclusion that he had not had anything to do with the deportation of the Jews, although he had undoubtedly known about the deportation, as anybody living in Salonika must have done if they hadn't been blind, since it involved the deportation of a quarter of the city's population in a matter of months. However, he had been involved in a wide variety of other activities which didn't look so good either, amongst them the planning and execution of a German army attempt to wipe out the guerrilla resistance. And as I read through these microfilms, it became evident to me that the Germans' anti-partisan policy had involved an extraordinarily high level of brutality against the civilian population. It involved the burning down of hundreds of villages, the random execution, shooting and hanging of all sorts of civilians that they encountered along their way, according to quotas, 50 for any attack on a German soldier and so on, in an attempt, an unsuccessful attempt to stamp out the guerrilla movement.
Now, what this led you to, in effect, Mark Mazower, was the consideration of what happens to a people when it is occupied by an army. In this case, we're talking about Nazi Germany. How do you figure out avenues into such a terribly complex problem?
Well, perhaps I can explain this by describing, as it were, the state of play of the understanding of this period at the time. After the war ended, there was a bitter civil war in Greece. The result was, for the next 30 years, historians spent all their time arguing about who was to blame. Was it the communist-backed resistance movement, guerrilla movement? Was it the Americans and the British? The pendulum swung to and fro, and this argument would be pushed back into the wartime period to criticize the British, for example, for having not done more to stamp out the resistance movement in its early stages, or to criticize them for having stamped it out when they should have been supporting them, and so on. This seemed to me to be by now a completely redundant debate, because there was no consideration of the experience of living under Nazi occupation, and I was curious to know, for example, who had gone into the resistance and why. They certainly, most of them, had not gone into the resistance planning to fight the Cold War, which they didn't know would break out.
That's a construction that we've come up with in retrospect.
That's right. Uh-huh. And the other obvious feature of this debate was that the Germans didn't feature anywhere in it. And yet, reading through Waldheim's wartime documents, it was obvious that the German policy was brutal, harsh, had a devastating effect on every aspect of people's daily lives. And therefore, well, there had to be another story there that hadn't been told about the impact of the German occupation on Greek society, Greek politics, and so on.
Is there a way quickly to summarize that impact or that effect? How do you reduce that to generalities?
What you had in Greece during the war was the complete breakdown of a society and its political system. And this seemed to me something of intrinsic human interest then. What do people do when the political fabric that they've grown up with is dissolved? What do they do when their social structures are destroyed, when their houses are destroyed, when they're forced elsewhere, when an entire society crumbles?
You have written, for example, that, what was it, 40, 50,000 people starved to death. This is human experience being pushed absolutely to the limit. I mean, this is the next step before the concentration camps, I take it.
Yes, indeed, many Greeks believe, mistakenly as it turns out, that the Germans were planning to exterminate them. And they believe this because in the first winter of the occupation, 40 or 50,000 people starved to death, and people walking down the streets in the center of the capital, Athens, are seeing corpses lying there, or people in the last stages before dying, lying there begging for food. And these things have become quite ordinary to them.
Well, what in fact did the Greek people do? How did they survive these terrible odds?
Well, you can look at this on two levels. In the first place, there's a push for collective action, and this is what interested me. This was the origins of the resistance. People's society has collapsed. They form a new underground society, and that becomes the resistance. And it's formed in conditions of extreme violence, and it becomes highly violent itself, and at the same time, of course, highly idealistic.
Well, now that's what sets the stage for the continuation of this civil war that goes on, as you said, for 30 years after the end of World War II.
That's absolutely right. And at the same time, parallel with that, there are all the individual histories that are caused by the repercussions of this sort of experience.
Are the modern Greeks still living with World War II after a fashion? You know, in our American mass culture, we seem to have put it behind us completely. It's movies and television. How about it? Are the Greeks still living with it?
No, this raises a very interesting question. What happens when wars end? In particular, what happens when civil wars end? And historians haven't really begun to tackle this. If you go to Greece, what's very striking is that to a large extent they have put this behind them. Mm-hmm. It took long enough It took several generations. But for today's generation, the animosities of the war and of the civil war are a matter of history. They are something that preoccupy their grandparents, even their parents, but something that for them are mere matters of history. And that in itself is an interesting and important phenomenon.
How does all of this, you've been describing here the Nazi occupation of Greece, Mark, how does all of that help to set the stage for what we call the Cold War?
Well, I think a number of historians now agreed that by the last year of the Second World War, large parts of Europe, and for that matter Greece, are fighting what is in effect a civil war. A civil war that in many cases has been stimulated and provoked by the SS, but that has indigenous roots that stretch back over many generations. The result is that when Europe becomes polarized after 1945 over time between the Western camp and the Soviet camp, these internal polarizations, these civil wars that have been fought on class lines in Greece and in Italy, on ethnic lines between Poles and Ukrainians, mm-hmm. these take on a Cold War dimension.
Or the lid gets put on them after a fashion.
After a few years, the lid gets put on them. But there are a few years in the late 1940s that we now tend to forget about of extraordinary violence. You may know, for example, in the Baltic states, there is a guerrilla insurrection against the Soviet Union that requires 8 Red Army divisions to suppress over 3 years. In Italy, you have partisans going back up into the hills because they fear that American capitalism is being imposed upon them. It requires grenade throwers and special paramilitary units operating with the Italian police to imprison them. In Greece, of course, you have a very bitter civil war. So in these ways, you don't really have a clear break. You have a transition between the violence, the extreme violence of the end of the Second World War and the international polarization of the Cold War.
Now, this is what has been simmering all these years and which is now reemerging, coming again to a boil when we speak of the end of communism and the fall of the Soviet Union.
That may be so. This is, of course, one of the most controversial and difficult areas of interpretation of the modern world. Is it right to see these tensions as things that have been there, as it were, beneath the surface? My own view is that that's probably not the case, because if you had travelled round, let us say, Yugoslavia in the 1970s or the 1980s, you would have found very high degrees of intermarriage across ethnic boundaries, and you would not have found people wishing to replay the old ethnic conflict.
Well, how do we account for the breakout then, the bringing to the boil, as it were, of these tensions?
I think you require a political rather than a social explanation. Rather than saying, as it were, these tensions were innate, were there below the surface, you have to see what happened when the control of the superpowers vanished. And with it, especially in Eastern Europe, the legitimizing ideology of communism and the vacuum which new political forces filled. Now, what messages could they offer to their people? The most evident, the most easily to hand was that of ethnic particularism, of nationalism. And with state control of the media, as we see most tragically in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia, it was not difficult to whip up tensions that existed into something approaching hatred.
Mark Mazower, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We're talking about your overview of European history in the 20th century. Let me bring you back to a sort of polarity or tension that you mentioned earlier in our conversation. That is to say, the ascendancy of the state, the rights of the individual. What do you see as we move toward the end of the decade and into the new millennium here?
Well, I was quite intrigued to read in the New York Times a couple of days ago a Russian general in charge of the Red Army detachment leaving Berlin, saying we need a decent celebration here to celebrate the ending of the post-war era. I absolutely agree with him. The post-war era has come to an end. And the post-war era, for my money, in Western Europe, and for that matter in the United States, perhaps less so, comprised an interesting combination of liberalism as in regard to human rights and collectivism of some description with regard to economic relations. In other words, you had welfare states and the principle accepted by large numbers of people that the state should intervene in the economy, and this was not necessarily socialism, this might be something more akin to social democracy. Now, over the last 10 years, of course, that component has been changed radically by the Thatcher-Reagan revolution. There are calls for the state to shrink, although it's more difficult to do that in practice than in theory.
theory, but the tide has turned over the last 10 years against the forms of social democracy that had formed our world in the post-war era. For my money, I found this profoundly disturbing because I don't believe that the theoretical arguments of the free market had won the day. I believe it was essentially a political battle that was won. And I have little confidence that the free market can solve the problems that the social democratic solution is supposed to have failed in.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Mark Mazower. In all of this work that you do as a historian of international relations, are you writing really about the military and diplomats and social forces, or are you writing about the sort of human heart issues, the moral issues that drive all of these great events?
I must confess that by temperament I'm drawn more to the latter, and that's partly because I find them more interesting. I'm often surprised at how boring a lot of professional history is, and yet when you go and look in the archives,
right,
what strikes you is the incredible fascination of the human spirit, the unpredictability of the things that people will say that no novelist could possibly imagine. I never imagined myself as a novelist, but I would never want to be because my imagination would never be sufficient to rival the things that I have found in the documents. And I'm always drawn, therefore, to try and incorporate as many different voices with as many unexpected, incongruous, colorful, bizarre, tragic experiences as I can, because for my money, those are what make history interesting.
Mark Mazower recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. His most recent book is Inside Hitler's Greece, available from Yale University Press. Mark Mazower is a lecturer in history at the University of Sussex. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For an audio cassette of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 720. That's program number 720, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Part 9 of New Southerners, our continuing series of programs highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. Tina McElroy Ansa will be here to talk about her latest novel, Ugly Ways, a story of a mother and her daughters in the modern South. Funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Annenberg Foundation, with additional support from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.